show too wide a smile, because he had, after all, a reputation for self-restraint to keep up. Much of the time, Ivory fought to rid football from his life, to call a merciful halt to the practices, the dreaded gassers, the reading of page after page of plays and game plans, the endless demands on his time. He liked the games, there was no denying that, but it was hard not to find the rest of it pointless. There were other coaches around the league who drooled over Ivory's size and speed, 195 pounds and growing, with a 4.7 in the 40, and his strength. He could bench press 275 pounds as a 16-year-old. They thought he had major college talent written all over him, but Ivory didn't. He was so sure of it, he wasn't even going to bother to take the SAT or ACT entrance exams, which made it virtually impossible for him to get a major college scholarship, even if anyone was interested. Maybe it would have been different if the coaches had let him start at middle linebacker his junior year. He had had the talent for it, there was little question about that, but the coaches simply didn't trust Ivory at the show position of the Permian defense. They switched him to offensive guard, and he played it brilliantly. But something snapped in Ivory after middle linebacker was wrested from him. The common explanation he wasn't raw enough didn't make any sense to him, although the coaches were hardly the only ones who found him to be stubborn and headstrong. But the way Ivory saw it, they just wanted to deprive him of glory, of what was rightfully his. And where was all this rah-rah stuff supposed to come from? Was it simply expected that he would become indoctrinated into the blinding passion of the mojo mystique, just like everyone else? He was aware of it. Everybody in town was. But up until the sixth grade, Permian was off limits to him, because the school system was segregated. If you lived on the south side, as Ivory's family did, there was no way of going there. Instead, the big school in town was Ector, which wasn't too far from his home. Ector didn't have the football tradition that Permian had, but it had won state twice in basketball, residents of the south side packing the tiny school gym to the rafters with 1,200 fans, while others, who couldn't get in, climbed the roof and stared in the windows. That was the tradition Ivory had grown up with, not mojo. Relegated to the position of guard, he had played football out of a dutiful sense of obligation, because it made his father proud, and also because it somehow seemed his destiny to do so, regardless of what he thought about it. After all, if you were a strong, fast black kid in Odessa, what else were you encouraged to do? What other outlet did you possibly have? When you looked around, where else did you see a single black role model, except in church? He had talked with his father, Ivory Sr., about it, and he told him he wasn't sure he wanted to play college ball, even if he had the chance. The way the words came out of his mouth, so flat and dispirited, Ivory Sr. thought his son might be burned out on the whole thing altogether, the rigors of being seriously involved in football since the age of 9 finally getting to him. He had been playing the game for 8 years, as long as it took to go to medical school, serve an internship, and complete a residency. But what loomed down the road because of it? Ivory couldn't see a thing. His father had played football in Odessa in the 60s, when there was an all-black high school in town called Blackshear. The team had played in its own stadium on the south side with equipment that looked like something used in a junior high, and it played in the high school version of the Negro League, its opponents, the all-black schools of Amarillo and Lubbock and Midland. Those were the days of strict segregation, and the idea of playing for Permian was, of course, almost inconceivable. Ivory Sr. took great pride in his son's accomplishments. In the back of his mind, it was probably hard not to think about what football could do for his son and how it could make him the first member of the Christian family ever to go to college. But Ivory Sr., who drove a truck for a living, wasn't going to push him. He would abide by his son's decision if Ivory chose not to play football anymore after high school. He also knew his son was a teenager going through changes who had, perhaps for the first time, found there might be something else in life besides football to fill up the empty spaces of Odessa that loomed as large as skyscrapers. It had come to Ivory in a dream. When he related it to his father, he talked about being in a narrow tunnel with a tiny light that he could barely see, but he knew he had to find, no matter how difficult it was. To Ivory, the message of the dream was crystal clear. He was living his life wrong, emphasizing all the wrong things, football and hanging out in the streets with his friends and alcohol and marijuana. The day after he had the dream, he went to church with a hangover on his breath and Jesus in his heart, as he later described it. He told the pastor at his church, Rose of Sharon Missionary Baptist, about the dream and how he was convinced that it had been a calling to preach and become part of God's ministry. Pastor Hansen welcomed Ivory's conversion. He knew that Ivory was an influential kid whose actions made a tremendous impression on his peers. But there was something worrisome about it, and he didn't want Ivory moving from one world of isolation into another where the only difference was the level of standards. Before, Ivory had displayed undisguised contempt for just about everything, an attitude of what Hansen perceived as arrogance. Now he displayed a rigid righteousness that made him almost a kept prisoner. At home, he hardly communicated with anyone, but went immediately to his tiny room where he listened to the gospel music of James Cleveland. He went on this way for hours on end until his mother began to worry and think there was something wrong with him. Why was he so withdrawn, so quiet? As a result of his conversion, he hated alcohol and had contempt for those who touched it. He also hated swearing, and other players in the locker room figured it was better to abide by his wishes rather than run the risk of messing with him. Before his calling to the ministry, he had dated. Now, he started grilling girls about their habits to see if their moral standards were high enough for him. "Not everyone you meet is going to be a jam-up Christian," Hansen told him. "They may drink a beer, they may go to a concert. You can still be Ivory. You can still be 18 years old. You don't have to be 40 years old. You don't have to isolate yourself." But Ivory's metamorphosis was total. A far cry from the days when he had led the chorus of laughter in response to the church teachings about fornication. And rarely had Hansen seen anyone with as instinctive a gift for preaching. He was amazed at Ivory's comprehension and interpretation of the scripture and his ease in the pulpit, the absolute fearlessness he showed in getting up before the congregation and preaching the word of God with those square shoulders that did make him look as though he was born to be a linebacker. Wearing a blue suit with a little trim of white handkerchief sticking out of the breast pocket, Ivory made a striking figure. His poise like that of someone 30 years old instead of 17. He truly seemed at peace in these moments, able at last to lose himself in something without anguish and ambivalence. He rocked back and forth and nodded his head as Hansen gave the altar prayer one Sunday. Moments later, he was introduced as the Reverend Ivory Christian. The very ring of it sounded stirring and wonderful. And it was amazing to see this teenager, who showed almost no enthusiasm about anything, who responded to almost everything with the shrug of an octogenarian ready to die, take the pulpit. He started softly, but the exhortations of the congregation, "Talk, talk," and "All right, all right," and "Take your time, son, take your time," got him going in a sweet and easy rhythm. He connected with the congregation, and they connected with him as he stood beneath a mural of the black Jesus and talked about his conversion. "When you let go of this world, Jesus puts a certain joy in your heart. Do we really love him enough to say no to the world?" Ivory let go of drinking. He let go of hanging out in the streets. He let go of parties. He let go of cussing. He let go of every formal vestige in his life except football. It still lingered as his perpetual, unconquerable nemesis. He tried to let go of that, too, and he talked to Hansen about quitting football altogether because he felt it conflicted with his calling, and he didn't want anything to get in the way of that. But Hansen gently coaxed him not to drop football too fast. It was there, and it had a place in Ivory's life, whether he liked it or not. If playing football can get you to college, if playing football can get you an education, then play football, Hansen had told him. And no matter how much Ivory tried to hate it and belittle it and scoff at it, something took hold of him on game day as surely powerful as spreading the word of Jesus. Everyone on the team experienced butterflies, but no one got them as badly as he did. It hadn't happened in the first game of the season against El Paso Austin, because everyone knew that El Paso Austin was a terrible team. But it did happen in the second game, in a stadium 530 miles east of Odessa in Marshall, Texas. As assistant coach Randy Mays went over the list of the myriad responsibilities of the linebackers one final time, the drone of his footballese a numbing wash in the bloated air, Ivory's legs began to shake. He started sweating, and his complexion turned wan. The more Mays read from the piece of paper he had prepared, which was based on hours of review of several Marshall game films, where every play was diagrammed and analyzed for type, formation, and hash tendency, the worse Ivory looked, as if he was drowning in the expectations of what he had to do. The alien atmosphere of everything, the strange space he and his teammates occupied underneath the decrepit flanks of the bleachers with its spotted shadows and jutting angles, the crackling screech of anchors away over and over again on the ancient loudspeaker system to an absolutely empty stadium, the tortuous buildup of heat and humidity, like the cranking of a catapult, only magnified the tension. "You okay?" Mays asked him. "I need to throw up," he said. "Go throw up." And off he went, trying to exorcise the demon of football. Perhaps it was the distance that separated the two schools, and the fact that Permian, at a cost of $20,000 to the school district, had chartered a 737 jet to get to Marshall. Perhaps it was the breakfast at Johnny Case's Seafood and Steakhouse, where he sat in the corner with the other black players and helped himself to heaping buffet-style portions of scrambled eggs and biscuits and chicken-fried steak. Perhaps it was how some of the shoe polish signs on the rear windows of cars in Marshall rhymed mojo with homo, or the way the Marshall Mavericks slumped against the doorway of the locker room in their letter jackets when the Permian players arrived. Their arms folded, the looks on their faces smug and sullen and smirking, as if to say, "So this is Big Bad Mojo, the pride of West Texas. They look like a bunch of pussies to me." But probably it was the thought of Odell, as he had been called all that week during the practice, staring across from him in the Marshall backfield. Odell Beckham, the stud duck of the Mavericks, number 33, 6 feet, 194 pounds, 4.5 speed in the 40, punishing, quick, able to take it up and out to the outside, a guaranteed lock for a major college scholarship. Odell. Everywhere Ivory went, everywhere he looked, that's all we seemed to hear about. Odell. Watch him do this on the film. Odell. Read about him doing that on the scouting report. Odell. Listen to this publication calling him the third best running back in the state. Odell. Could any player possibly be that good, that awesome, that intimidating? Were the rumors true that he had walked on water against the Nacogdoches Dragons and had simply flown across the field like the Flying Nun against the Texarkana Tigers? Inside the locker room of the Marshall Mavericks, where a sign in thick red letters on the Coke machine read, "There's nothing that comes easy that's worth a dime. As a matter of fact, I never saw a football player make a tackle with a smile on his face." Ivory went through the physical upheaval, as far removed from the cocoon of the Rose of Sharon pulpit as he ever could be. He wasn't preaching now. He was playing football. Part 2. The Marshall game was only the second of the season, and since it wasn't a league contest, it had no effect on whether Permian made the playoffs. But the stakes seemed as great as in a state championship, and the air swirled with the edgy sensation that the two teams on the field wanted nothing more than to bludgeon the bloody bejesus out of one another. Marshall came into the game ranked third in the state and badly desired a hunk of mighty Mojo's hide to prove the Mavericks were for real. That's why the coach, Dennis Parker, had begged the school principal to schedule the game, the first ever between the two schools, despite the distance between them. I told him, we can have 10 merit scholars at school, but if we beat Permian, we get more publicity. Permian came into the game ranked fourth in the state, with a reputation of invincibility to uphold. Out on the plains of West Texas, everyone knew how the Panthers routinely bludgeoned opponents from El Paso and Abilene and Amarillo. But could they handle the pressure of playing in a hot and hostile environment where thousands drenched from head to toe in Maverick Red would be screaming for their heads? Could Winchell hang in if the game got tight and they had to have it? Could Gaines? Could Ivory Christian? They got a sellout in Marshall, Gaines told his players several days before the game. They'll have 8,000 or 9,000. A lot of fan interest down there for this game. I want you to keep in mind why we're going. It's not a pleasure trip. It's work. We're going to work. If Permian could survive here, in this rickety stadium hundreds of miles away from home that felt so much like the scene of some bloody ambush before the biggest crowd that had ever watched a football game in Marshall, Texas, it could survive anywhere. But if the Panthers lost... Odell off tackle on the first play with thousands screaming. Ivory and outside linebacker Chad Payne in his face to drive him to the ground. A loss of 3. Odell off tackle on the next series. Ivory there again, leading the swarming charge of a defense coming at him like darts shot out of a .44 Magnum. A gain of 2. Odell on a draw, into the open field, eludes Ivory, won't go down as the Permian defensive backs ride his back, sprawls on the ground for every inch to a delighted, roaring crowd. Gain of 13. Welcome to East Texas football, Ivory. Stick it up your ass. Odell again, busted by Ivory, a hit that sounds and reverberates. He crumples and loses the ball. Welcome to West Texas football, Odell. Stick it up your ass. New series. Odell again on a draw. Carries 4 tacklers with him for a gain of 6. Odell to the right side. Stacked up for a gain of 1. Odell on a pitch. Ivory leads the charge for a loss of 2. A scout from a neighboring school that will play Marshall in several weeks has his binoculars trained on the game. He's supposed to be watching Odell, and he knows Odell is great. But his eyes keep sliding off to Ivory. He keeps poking his colleague in the side and saying, "You're not going to believe this, but that number 62 has made another tackle." It may be that Ivory Christian hates football. It may be that he's burned out on it. It may be that he considers it pointless, an 8-year journey to nowhere. But it also may be that under the right circumstances, the demon wins the heart of the most steadfast soul, and the nemesis always becomes a lover. Permian goes ahead 3-0 in the first quarter on a 25-yard field goal by Alan Wiles. But Marshall, capitalizing on a fumble by Comer, moves deep into Permian territory and then scores on a 6-yard lob pass from Benny Valentine to flanker Alfred Jackson. The ravenous Marshall fans go wild at this first indication that Mojo can actually be beaten. The score remains 7-3 at the end of the first half. The Permian players head into the